I'm studying Cerambycid, boring beetle, in forests of Arkansas. And this is, the red oak borer is an insect that's known to science, but we really only know a little bit about its basic biology and life history. We know that it attacks species in the red oak group, particularly northern red oak and scarlet oak and black oak. So first I'm going to give you a little background on its life history, and then I'm going to talk about the recent outbreak that's occurred in Arkansas oak forest.
Show you a real example how this actually works. This is the genus Obsiphenes. These are the weird ones that want to occur where I am. And when you barcode the set, that's an NJ tree there with one male to go with each one of the lumps in the barcode tree. There they are, very straightforward. You can tell them all apart, no problem at all. And you can tell them apart morphologically as well. Very well-known group of butterflies. You catch them with bait traps, okay? Real simple. Well, notice that right down here, the bottom, whoops, I goofed it. See if I can recover from that just a minute here. There we go. Right down at the bottom, there we go, right down there, is a little lump, sort of a wobble. See, right down in there, a little lumpy thing. And we have learned to be very suspicious of little things like that, especially when there's a full-length sequence associated with it. And they are. These are 657 base pair barcodes. Well, you go and you take that little lump down there and you look at the specimens that actually contributed. And this, one thing incidentally barcoding does to you, it turns you into a museum. Because you find yourself saying, oh my God, I have to save every single specimen because you want to go back and look at it again. When you look at that, you suddenly discover that that butterfly, it looks superficially like the one just above it, like Cassini, in whose lump it's sitting. But you can see, I think, the slight difference in the wing. Look at the forewing in the center of the forewing. You see that the little orange wiggle is separate from the band on the side. And you go and you look at the girls that go with it, and you suddenly discover that the female is very different. The male of the female of the normal one is at the top, the white one, the white wings. She's got white. The female wasn't known of this thing until we reared it. The point is, it leaps out at you with its barcode. It's been overlooked God knows how long, and I have no idea how many of these are going to show up in collections now when we go back and look in Obsiphenes collections for that one little wiggly trait. And that's obviously, it turns out to be a new species of Obsiphenes. Say, well, that one is, you know, that's got a morphological trait that I can see. Yeah, uh-huh. Okay, well, look at this one. This is a Proponolarites, very common butterfly to fruit. And you can see that on the left, there's two blocks. They're red and blue. And on the left, the blue one, sorry, is one lump of barcodes, and the red one is another lump. Now, this is a butterfly everybody knows. We've reared a jillion of them. But what always bothered me about the rearing data was that half of them are from, we've over 200, half of them are off of Chrysobalanaceae and the other half are off of Fabaceae. When you barcode them, they turn out to be two different animals, completely co-occurring. The caterpillars cannot be told apart, and neither can the adults. They're rainforest and dry forest, they're everywhere, and they completely co-occur, and they have two totally different biologies, one eating one group of plants and the other eating another group of plants. Say, well, how many more of these are there like this? Well, you see the thing that says Argyris amidon up there in the upper right-hand corner? Up there, notice at the top of this NJ tree, there's a deep fork. Well, that's the deep fork right there. This is two species of Argyris amidon, not only co-occurring in the same place, but on the same food plant at the same time. It's as though mama of one came along and laid her egg on that plant, and when the mama of the other one came along and said, wow, that's the right plant for me too, and bang, there they are on the same plant at the same time. As a matter of fact, if you take taxonomists who are very good at their group and you give them a long list and say, predict where the barcodes will split up things, they'll pick out the things where there's been a lot of variation, there's been arguments, where there's polymorphism, those things, and they're generally right. That's where the barcodes do split up. And what they'll miss is the ones that everybody knows. The one with the big yellow spot on the wing, the one with the big blue stripe down it, the one with one big spine sticking out of the back of the head. Because those are the ones that turn out to be also having complexes in them. But you miss the complex because it had this real easy key character. And here's that one nice example. Everybody knows what Bibulus hyperia is. It was in the trees that we saw here earlier today in Andre's tree. It's a very well-known animal. It's three animals in the same place, on the same food plant, with identical caterpillars. And so far I can't figure out any way to tell the adults apart, except by barcoding them, and they are very different. But the other side of this coin is there are a few things who have the same barcode but are very different in appearance and morphology. And this is one very good one. Adelpha melanthi and Adelpha phylacca, different subgenera of Adelpha, are indistinguishable by their barcodes. And the caterpillars are very similar. The food plants are very similar as well. And my interpretation of this thing is that this thing has split apart very recently. Their barcodes haven't had time to separate from each other. But there's been strong selection. As we know, all Adelphas are mimics of somebody. And they has been strong selection for these two to diverge as adult appearances. Now, the barcode itself obviously has, it's like any tool. It's tricky. You have to learn how to use its tricks. And a very nice example is this pair of skippers. The upper one is just described by John Burns. And it's the clear dots in the tree on the left. There, and you'll see that there's one up in the middle, one down there, and then there's some black and white intermingled, and then white ones down here at the bottom, i.e. the barcodes are not separating this pair of very similar skippers. So what's wrong? Does the barcode fail? No. If you take and knock out all the short barcodes, the 350s, the 400s, the 450s, the 500s, and then redo your tree, you get perfect separation of these two species. They differ by one base pair. So if you don't pick up that one base pair difference, they get lumped together. But if you've got a nice, clean 650 base pair sequence for them, no problem telling them apart. So what happens when you get down to these nasty little things? You know, flies all look like house flies, don't they? That's what tachinids are. Well, we've been spent 20 years doing, Bonnie Wood has been doing these things for 20 years, so we have a really good understanding from a morphological standpoint of what a lot of the tachinids look like. So you take those, remember I said in that tree earlier, in that slide earlier, there are 16 generalist tachinids that have these very long lists of caterpillars, each one of them. You know, 45 species in many families and so on. What happens when you barcode those? Well, this is the guy who does all the work at Guelph, Alex Smith. And you take one leg off, so the enormous number of five-legged flies in Canada now. And those 16 generalist species turned into 73 species. And people say, but do you believe that, Dan? Those 73 species match their caterpillar species, the hosts, extremely well. Extremely well. But there still are 9 generalists. So we still have John Lyell's generalists, but they're not as general as they were before. So you had some generalists with 45 species of caterpillars, and you barcode them, and suddenly all the ones who eat swallowtails are off on another branch. The barcode picks out that set. And then what happens is, you know what they look like. That's one morphological species of fly. And it's 9 barcode species, each one with its own host plant, host caterpillar. So now what happens is you get this. If you take the two on the left, look at the width of the 3 black bands on the dorsal part of that segment in the middle of the abdomen, on the upper one, and then look at the width of the 3 black bands on the lower one. That's what was called variation. The one on the top eats Manduca delucida, one species of sphingid. The one on the bottom eats Manduca coralina. These grow side by side on 2 different food plants in the same forest. And that was all, of course, treated as Drinorrhea. It was just one species. When you barcode them, suddenly the taxonomist wants to go back now and look at every single individual that he looked at morphologically beforehand to see where they fit. And you decide, lo and behold, there's beautiful characters like this, but they were overlooked or they were dumped into the category called variation. Josephine is going to talk, Rodriguez is going to talk this afternoon about her ridiculous little Panley's black wasp. This is one species, Panley's leucostigmus, that breaks up into 32 when you barcode them. And they all match their own individual caterpillars. So instead of being a generalist who ate basically all species of skippers, which is what everybody thought leucostigmus was, it's in fact a horrible complex of specialists, each one eating a small number of species of skippers. Now, this is a hyperparasite. This is a trigonelida. These guys, mama goes along and lays her eggs on the leading edge of the leaf where the caterpillar is eating, and so it swallows the eggs, and then we're going through the parasitization of the tachinid who's inside the caterpillar. Okay, so they come out in different sizes depending on how big the tachinid was, but everybody knows that T. gunlachii is sort of, you know, the hyper. It's from Pennsylvania all the way down into South America somewhere. Get it in malaise traps all the time. Very well known. Why, it's the bald eagle of the hyperparasites, right? So we barcode it. It's 3 things in one place. and you look carefully at the three things, and what you discover is one of them is in dry forest, one is in rainforest, and the other is a little pocket in the middle of the dry forest. And they're very different at the level genetically, but morphologically, they're dead on each other. When you go and look at a nuclear sequence, for those people who are worried about using mitochondrial DNA for this kind of identification process, it turns out that the rainforest one is at the nuclear sequence level different from the dry forest one. But the dry forest pocket disappears. So you can't tell them apart with a nuclear sequence, but you can tell them apart with CO1. So that's where we're headed. What do you need to make that work? You need the libraries against which you compare all this. And my plea to the entomological world is the same as to the plant world, or the mammal world, the bird world is, stop dragging your feet. Get on the bandwagon and make use of it by getting sequences for all your favorite bugs. So they're in the library, so when we have a sequencer of some sort, people then can reference to your animals from Alaska to Wisconsin to Brazil or whatever they happen to be. Second, we need the gadget. Now, the gadget's out of my control, it's out of your control, but these guys who love to do things in Silicon Valley, they'll make the gadget, okay? That'll come along of its own accord. The actual statement that's on the table right now is, Dan, put $10 million on the table and you have the gadget in 2 years. That's where technology is at this level. I can't control that. That's other people who do that. So what we have to do is we have to provide the sequence libraries. So when you stick a leg into a hole in the gadget that you pull out of your back pocket, there is a sequence somewhere that references to it. It's just all we're talking about really is gene bank in a bottle, okay? I think there should be a toll booth. Nobody seems to want to listen to this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think that every time you put a leg in your gadget and you get a name back, a penny should drop in a bucket. And a bucket should be used to fund the taxonomic process that's behind all of this. Okay? And finally, you need some place where there's information that you get when you have a name, which is what, of course, EOL is, what GBIF is, and all the other mechanisms by which your information gets to someone who puts the name in. The problem we have is that none of the computers, none of the cell phones, none of the handhelds, none of the Blackberries at the present time have got the hole in it that you stick your leg in. You can't get the information out of Google that's there at the present time unless you have a taxonomist on a chain. Okay? I feel that bioliteracy, which is what you'll have when you can really identify anything, anywhere, anytime, has a potential relationship to wild biodiversity between people and wild biodiversity as real literacy has had between people. Now, there's a direct analogy here. To me, the barcoder, the gadget, and its library and all of the information behind it is equivalent to at least these things. Now, why would I make such a wild-eyed statement? I mean, obviously, in many ways, these are not the same thing. But they all have something in common. Every one of those things has something in common. The something they have in common is that there's something there for everybody. The housewife, the farmer, the game warden, the taxonomist, the graduate student, everybody has use for it. And they have use for these things. That's why the camera was developed back in the Civil War. How long did it take for there to be one in every house? 50, 70 years. And it was because Kodak decided, I'm going to put one in every house and every person can have their own camera. The same with a Model T Ford, the same with airplanes, all and so on. So what we're really talking about is democratization of biodiversity. Thank you very much.
So we have time for questions. If anyone has questions for Dan and Winnie as well, so apparently we have lots of questions.
Yes, sir.
What do you consider to be a species?
For me, as an ecologist, the same thing I've always considered to be. It's a batch of individuals that are, at least potentially, and probably actually are, interbreeding with each other. And that's it.
But still, you would call morphologically, ecologically similar organisms different species because they have slightly different DNA. You haven't done any...
Because they have different DNA, they have different morphology, which you find when you look, but you overlooked beforehand, and they have different biologies. They eat different caterpillars, or they eat different food plants. So, in other words, for my entire ecologist life, if I knew nothing about genetics, and you came to me and you said, these are morphologically different, and they do different things, I would say, yeah, they're different species. I'm now adding another trait. Now once I've added the other trait, the genetic trait, I feel even happier to call it two different species. And furthermore, I will now use as a shorthand any one of those traits, morphology or food plant or genetics, to identify it, to actually say, aha, this individual belongs to that species, okay? And just as we do now when we don't use barcoding, I say to you, hear that bird call, you say, ah, that's a such and such. But how do you know? Well, because I know that bird call is correlated with a set of other traits, but I use the bird call as a key character. And I'm saying that I feel comfortable using the barcode trait as a key character, just like I use food plants, just like I use morphology as key characters. But to me, that's a key character for the Mia species, which is the set of individuals running around and courting and having babies and doing all of that stuff. And so if you ask, well, how do I know if the one in Cuba is a different species from the one on the mainland? I have the same problem I do with morphology. I don't know. But I have another trait, that's all. Yeah?
I'm wondering how the greater resolution from the barcoding has changed your view of diversification of these organisms in Costa Rica.
Well, without doubt, it's changed my view in the sense of a lot of the things that I thought were sloppy are no longer sloppy. In other words, I had a moth who feeds on Proteaceae and feeds on Leguminosae. And I thought, yeah, that's really crazy. How can I have one species eating these two very different, chemically very different food plants? I barcode them and I discover that, oops, that's two different species. One specialized on Proteaceae, one specialized on Fabaceae. So the mystery's gone. It just cleans up a whole lot of, as an ecologist, it cleans up a whole lot of those relationships. And the second thing is that I now have a way of feeling much more certain about identifications. I'll be very blunt, and this is not to run anybody down, but I've been a collaborator with taxonomists my whole career. And we all make mistakes. And what I do routinely now is barcode everything. And what happens is then this set of specimens, which we thought came from here and were identified this way, come out of a different barcode. I take them back to the taxonomist, and we look carefully, and we say, my goodness gracious, this one over here, in fact, is different from this one over here based on morphology. And suddenly, I feel more confident about my statements of what I'm dealing with than I did before. So here we have a volcano in the middle. We got the same name on the top of the volcano and down here at the bottom. Is that really the same thing? Well, it was called the same thing because that's the level of the taxonomic resolution took it. We barcode them and discover there's a distinctive set of barcodes here and a distinctive set here. I take them back to the taxonomist. They look at it and say, ah, Dan, you know what? My goodness, you know, all the ones on the top have got three spines in the genitalia and the ones down below have two and a half spines. And I just thought that was variation, but in fact, it's consistent now that you've separated them this way. It could be done with morphology. It could be if we all took our morphology and just really ground it into the ground, you'd get the same results that I'm getting here. And the same for the ecology. With the acceptance of food plant, Mama does make mistakes on food plants now and then. She does put the eggs in the wrong place. But that's different, and you can distinguish between the mistakes and the realities then. Oh, sorry. Yeah, Jack.
I've got a practical question, Dan. We've got this database of 300 million specimen records over 100 years. What happens when you've had this well-known species that you've entered all these observational records for so long, you discover there's three different things? Practically, how do you manage that with all of those earlier records?
Right now, on a smaller scale of just 20 years of doing it with 350,000 records, what I'm doing at the moment is, let's say that thing that I've been doing has got one name on it. Well, you saw an example up here of Propona laertes. What you probably didn't notice, it said Propona laertes and said DHJ01 fused on the Latin name here, and then it said Propona laertes DHJ fused onto it. If you go on my database, you'll discover that three names. There's Propona laertes with no DHJ01 or 02, because those were ones that there won't be, and laertes there are none, because once I discovered that one of them eats one food plant family and the other food plant eats the other food plant family, I named them
accordingly. I use the food plant then as the character. But there are other parallel cases where there are three, because the early one, I have no specimens to barcode. I have no, or a parasite killed them, or they died of disease. So I don't know which one of the two is. So it sits there with that Latin name. And then the other two where I do, we barcode it, and I know that they're separate, and then they get this interim name stuck on it, DHJ01 and DHJ02. Later on, I have to do the same thing we do with morphology. What happens when you discover that there's two morphologically? Forget the barcode. What do? You go and you describe one, and just tough luck for all that previous literature. And I'm going to have exactly the same problem. Monty Wood has got his Drinopice of interest. The whole world knows what Drinopice of interest is. It's 21 species of flies. So his problem is, first off, can I find the type, if it exists? And maybe can we nail it down to one of the 21? Maybe, maybe not. And then the other 21, basically, you might have some synonym types, some syntypes that are, not syntypes, but synonyms that are out there that can be resurrected and attached to one or the other. But the bottom line is all the early records that deal with Drinopice of interest, they are mixes. So you take the list of flies, Drinopice really occurs in the United States. You take the list of caterpillars for Drinopice of interest in the United States in any one of the catalogs, it's nonsense. Or it's for this super, if you like a super species or some bigger word like that, that feeds on this list, but it's not a generalist anymore. It just isn't. And so, but you can't know who specific that record from in Southern Illinois, you can't know what animal that was that ate that caterpillar. So I don't have a real good pragmatic answer, but that's how I'm dealing with it. Yes, sir. Well, I don't deal with it because to me it's a parallel to what happened when we started looking at genitalia of insects. 50 years ago, when people started using genitalia as a character, they discovered a jillion species that people didn't realize were there. What did we do about that? Well, what we're just doing is discovering more diversity than we thought was there in the first place. And we have to deal with it in all the pragmatic way deals we deal, the pragmatic ways that we deal with more diversity. It's not because of the barcode isn't the problem. We're going to find more underneath it. I'm certain that we're overlooking a lot of species using CO1 as a key character. So I can't answer your question, but it's a generic question, which I don't feel responsible that I have to answer. Yeah, Jeff.
Yeah, I think there's a crazy perception that this puts taxonomists out of work. In fact, you could employ 30 to follow up on all of this for the descriptions in the formal work.
Absolutely. I mean, if one wanted to see this as a synergism, I'm providing enormous amount of work for taxonomists, and frankly, I'm trying very hard to raise large quantities of money to support large quantities of taxonomists. So, I mean, yeah, Winnie, go ahead.